Solidarity number 707, 24th of April, 2024, page 2. To green economic life, democracy. Big oil profits at records high in 2022. Editorial. The Scottish Government has dumped its 2030 emissions targets. Wind turbine and solar power construction is lagging. Electric vehicle growth is slowing. The EU has delayed new environmental regulations for agriculture because of farmers' protests. The Tory government's own Climate Change Committee has criticised its slackening of emission reduction targets. The Labour Party has backed down on its pledge of £28 billion green investment. Donald Trump looks like winning the 2024 US presidential election with "Drill, baby, drill" for oil as a foremost slogan. All that at a time when 2023 and early 2024 temperatures have been way above the already increasing trend. Climate scientists worry that global warming and environmental damage may come faster than previous, already ominous calculations. The divergence is rooted in democracy or the lack of it. Even in the USA, where environmental awareness is lower than in many other countries, 61% say that climate change is already affecting them somewhat or a lot. 74% say the USA should join international efforts to abate emissions. Except among older Republicans, a majority accepts that climate change is caused by human action. With clear democratic mechanisms to debate, implement, and get accountability on environmental policies and on how to manage the transition to greener economic life, an effective majority for transition would surely emerge. But capitalism is democratic only in limited and formal terms, a vote every 4 or 5 years, but most things decided above our heads. Big business, and a sizable chunk of small business too, is concerned above all for its predictable profits. Fossil fuel big business and business currently reliant on fossil fuel supplies have huge lobbying power. Government's grand plans remain vague because of it. The grand plans are eroded over time, a delay here, an exemption there, and then postponed or shelved. The fossil fuel giants' profits and share prices have remained high, with variations but high. All that has been done to green economic life has been shaped so as not to harm them. No wonder, then, that some workers, seeing green measures as threatening their jobs or their ability to drive to work or bringing huge bills for households' conversion, regard the issues as too distant for them to affect or even get swayed by green sceptic ideas. North Sea oil offshore workers have backed the Our Power plan, devised with union participation to secure jobs for them while phasing out fossil fuel extraction. The Safe Landing Group of Aviation Workers seeks a plan for cutting aviation emissions while offering a future for aviation workers' skills and jobs. As UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says, we are now at a point where we must do everything, everywhere, all at once to reduce emissions and environmental damage. Renewable energy and nuclear, reforestation and reshaping agriculture, using tax levers and using direct planning. But the frame for all plans must be public ownership and democratic control of the whole energy industry and of the banks and high finance, which allocate investment funds. Public ownership and democratic control to rid us of the dominant influence of plutocrats' profits, plus electrifying everything to squeeze out high emissions energy technologies. Solidarity works to win over the labour movement to such plans and to revitalise the labour movement so that it can become the democratic agency to push them through. Iranian left, this is not our war. Aman Kafa of the Worker Communist Party of Iran, Hikmatist official line, told Solidarity. Our slogan is, "This is not our war," and all our reports are that the response to that in Iran is good. The teachers' union has also put out a statement against continued war. As for the regime, it is clear that neither the Islamic Republic nor any regional or global power wants to escalate the war apart from Israel. Having said this, the Islamic Republic tries to show that any such war is to do with the defence of Palestinian people. The regime does, however, realise and knows that the society in Iran is not that of 1980s and the Iran-Iraq war. To start with, the regime and the balance of power in Iran of today is vastly different, particularly with the mass protests that have taken place in the recent years. Well, the Israel state is looking for war with Iran and hoping to bring in the USA on its side as a way out of its position of international isolation. The Islamic Republic does not want the war. It does not want the atmosphere of war as a means to push against the mass movement against it in Iran. Following the recent direct attacks by Iran and Israel, the regime in Iran tried to use the war atmosphere to increase pressure on women with enforcement of its dress code and moves against journalists, but that has largely backfired. There is no appetite for war in the population in Iran, and general opinion in Iran clearly shows the mass intent to oppose and stand against attempts of the regime to use the pretext of war to strengthen its rule in society. This has been expressed in a variety of ways, in the street protests and skirmishes with the regime's forces and in the declarations that have been made, for example, by the National Teachers Union, amongst others. It is certainly clear that the only way out is to resolve the issue of Palestine. Unless the state of Palestine is recognized, which has the same standing as Israel and other states, unless the political solution is implemented, we will, particularly in a world of today, where militarism is prevalent among all the states, regionally and globally, all be faced with one crisis after another. UK Friends are standing together. Standing Together, Israel's fastest-growing grassroots movement of recent years, unites Jews and Palestinians within Israel to fight for an equal and just society, for peace and against the occupation. UK FOST promotes their work in the UK for peace, justice and equality for Israel and Palestinians, Jews and Arabs, including an equal right to self-determination and for the full equality of Palestinian citizens of Israel. UK FOST promotes the benefits of joint struggles by Jews and Palestinians to this end. Solidarity 708. Because of the Workers' Liberty Conference on 27th and 28th of April, Solidarity 708 will have a masthead date 8th of May, not 1st of May. Page 3. Ceasefire, Peace, Two States by Ira Bekovic. Israel has deployed some troops to areas adjacent to Rafah, the city in southern Gaza. It has long threatened with a major incursion. Over 1 million displaced Gazan refugees are sheltering there, many in tents, and with no credible evacuation plan in place. Any Israeli incursion would almost inevitably lead to a civilian bloodbath. There are some indications Egypt is preparing to administer large encampments of refugees fleeing from Rafah. Escalation has also continued in the West Bank with a major raid on the Nershom's refugee camp. Last month, Israel declared nearly 2,000 acres of territory in the Jordan Valley state land, the largest formal annexation of land in decades. Another potential flashpoint is the Israel-Lebanon border, where an intensification of fighting between Israel and Hezbollah, the Islamist paramilitary party allied to Iran would be a means for both sides to escalate hostilities. On 17th of April, 14 soldiers and 4 civilians were injured when a Hezbollah drone struck a community centre in Arab al-Aramshi, a Bedouin village in northern Israel. The same day, Hezbollah also targeted the Mount Meron Air Traffic Control Centre. Israeli strikes on Thursday, 18th of April, targeted Hezbollah sites, killing Hezbollah commander Ismail Yusuf Baz. Hezbollah also attacked military sites associated with Israel's Iron Dome missile defense system, claiming to have killed soldiers. Negotiations. Qatar's prime minister has said his country is reassessing its role as a mediator in negotiations between Israel and Hamas, saying it has been exploited and abused. Those negotiations are still nationally ongoing, but with little sight of progress since Hamas rejected the latest ceasefire proposal. At the United Nations, the US used its veto to block a bid to recognize the state of Palestine as a full UN member. The move would have been symbolic, but an important symbol nonetheless. American opposition shows that despite its government's stated support for Palestinian statehood, there are major limits to the diplomatic pressure it is prepared to apply on this issue. The people of the region, Iranian, Arab, Jewish, Kurdish, and others, all have the right to security and life. Terror in West Bank by Rula Daoud, National Co-Director of Standing Together, transcribed from Instagram. Whilst everyone is talking about Israel's potential retaliation against the Iranian regime, nobody is talking about the ongoing attacks in Gaza or the settler terror taking place in the West Bank. This morning, 16th of April, we found out that another 2 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank, meaning that since Friday, 12th of April, 5 Palestinians have been killed in incidents related to settler violence. The perpetrators are likely not to face any consequences. Gaza is still under fire, and the Israeli military is continuing to prepare for an invasion of Rafah. The hostages are still in captivity, and there is little progress being made to secure a hostage deal. Further retaliation against the attack from the Iranian regime is not in the interests of anyone who lives there or anyone who lives in Iran. Retaliation only serves Netanyahu's political interests. It helps to distract from Gaza and the West Bank, and is a danger to everybody who's living in the Middle East. Then Alan Lee Green, National Co-Director of Standing Together, again transcribed from Instagram. This morning, 17th of April, we launched an ads campaign on all Israeli news outlets, reaching millions of Israelis, warning us of an Israeli attack on Iran and a potential regional war. Our ads warns of months in the shelters. No power, no infrastructure, drone and missile attacks, no work. We shouldn't be dragged into this. If we don't end this war and hostage situation now, it will blow up in our faces. We know our government is trying to lead us into a regional war instead of stopping the ongoing aggression in Gaza, releasing the hostages and stopping the bloodshed. Rather than bringing peace, safety and quiet, our government is dragging us into a regional conflict that will blow up in our faces. Think about the severe suffering of millions of people who could spend months in bomb shelters without electricity, education and infrastructure. We must not believe this undertaking will bring us security. Quite the contrary, we need to prevent another conflict rather than pushing for one. Our National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, has established a special police unit whose entire task is to prevent human rights activists and left-wing activists from accessing the occupied Palestinian territory. Why? So that they can't document the offences of the settlers, so that they can't document or resist the pogroms that the settlers carry out with the protection and supervision of the police and army. To prevent us from standing in solidarity with Palestinians in the occupied territories who live under an apartheid regime, a regime where Israeli Jewish settlers have all the rights. They can move freely. They benefit from army protection. They can vote and stand for elections to the parliament. They can enjoy every right of the Israeli state that governs them. But their Palestinian neighbours have no rights, neither human nor civilian. They are forbidden to move freely, forbidden to get protection or defend themselves, forbidden from voting or standing for office. Ben Givar thinks that if he prevents us from going there, we will not be aware of any of this, but he's mistaken. What we actually need to do is go there more and scoff at the police and laugh at Ben Givar, who believes he can hide the truth. Activists' agenda meetings. Thursday, the 2nd of May to the 6th of June, 8 p.m. Zoom study group on theses on Feuerbach. Saturday the 18th to Monday the 20th of May, Workers' Liberty Contingent to Lutte Ouvrière, Fête at Presley's near Paris. Templates, motions, texts to adapt for union branches and Labour parties. Top of the list are currently no work notices, abortion, decriminalisation. At work or on campus, we organise among health and local government, school and education workers on the railway and London Underground, in the civil service on uni campuses and more. Socialist feminist book clubs, Sheffield 6th of May, campaigns for UK Friends of Standing Together, Labour Left Internationalists, Workers Against the CCP, Free Our Union, Solidarity with Iranian Workers, Neurodivergent Labour, India Labour Solidarity, Ukraine Solidarity Campaign, Labour Campaign for Free Movement, contact details, activities, templates, motions, etc. See Workers' Liberty org agenda. For environmental campaigning, including mobilisation for Reclaim the Power at Drax in August, email Workers' Liberty. Page 4. Galloway and Unnecessary Culture Wars by Antidoto by Jim Denham. Given the Morning Star's often hyperbolic enthusiasm for the Don't Vote Labour drive and No Ceasefire, No Vote, NCNV, now merged with Andrew Feinstein's collective, the paper's coverage of its second conference on the 13th of April was subdued. That may be in part because it was no bigger and possibly somewhat smaller than the first conference on the 3rd of March. Socialist Worker carried a more detailed account of the event, noting that it was rather aimless until George Galloway, not mentioned in the MS report, quotes, rallied much of the room behind him, end quotes. The SWP, for all their faults, know about Galloway from bad experience with him 20 years ago and warned against his reactionary stance on a range of issues, including LGBT plus rights, migration and environmentalism. The failure of the MS report even to mention Galloway is something of a mystery, given the enthusiastic and largely uncritical coverage they gave him of his Rochdale election campaign, a possible, quotes, fork in the road for British politics, end quotes, editorial 1st of March. That reflected the claim by the Communist Party of Britain's Rob Griffiths that, quotes, in voting for George Galloway, people have supported the rights of the Palestinian people and rejected British imperialism's support for genocidal Israeli policies, end quotes. Peir failed to mention that during his campaign, Galloway's team sent out two letters. One addressed to Muslims emphasized Gaza. The other letter, aimed at white voters, didn't mention Gaza, but instead boasted of his record of backing Brexit, opposing Scottish independence, and supporting family values. A whole paragraph was dedicated to his opposition to transgender rights and his conviction that God creates everything in pairs. Quotes, "I believe in law and order," the letter reads. "There will be no grooming gangs in Rochdale, even if I have to arrest them myself," end quotes. It ends with a deliberate nod to Donald Trump promising to, quotes, "make Rochdale great again," end quotes. His so-called Workers' Party, in a leaflet, quotes, "offers a migration policy that reflects the anxiety felt among the working class about the influx of migrants, which appears to be out of control." It adds, "people are not wrong to worry about undue burdens being placed on local services and about the cost of hosting escalating numbers of asylum seekers," end quotes. It announces, quotes, apocalyptic green hysteria that floods our media, end quotes, and will keep an open mind about this reality of climate change, claiming there is, quotes, no need to be rushed, end quotes, into a green economy. People who rely upon the MS for the information would know nothing of this. One of Galloway's most enthusiastic supporters of the MS and a leading CPBer, Andrew Murray, in his Eyes Left column of 3rd of April, bemoans the fact that Owen Jones' We Deserve Better initiative seems unlikely to embrace Galloway, given that, quotes, they are in opposite trenches in those culture wars which divide socialists to the profit of our opponents, end quotes. What exactly Murray considers to be culture wars which unnecessarily divide socialists can be worked out from another recent column, 20th of March, where he describes Lee Anderson as speaking to, quotes, sections of the working class who regard the Tories as alien beings. Labour is now lost to people like them. Underlying Anderson's political journey seems to be a deep sadness at what has happened to mining communities like his in Nottinghamshire, end quotes. I suppose it's no surprise that someone who can paint such a sympathetic portrait of a racist, sexist, reactionary like Anderson is also happy to dismiss Galloway's similarly vicious right-wing politics as simply a matter of inconsequential culture wars. But does Murray speak for everyone at the MS and CPB? Free Speech, Even for the Odious, by Simon Nelson. April saw the attempted banning of the National Conservatism Conference in Brussels, the shutting down of a three-day Palestine Congress in Berlin, and the rescinding of a student's right to make a speech at their graduation at the University of Southern California, USC. Solidarity would share no common ground with the speakers or ideas of the Brussels conference. Speakers across the European hard and far right, including Viktor Orban, Nigel Farage and Suella Braverman, were billed to argue for anti-migrant, pro-family protectionist and low-tax ideals. Such a conference should be met with protests, and its speakers should not feel their ideas are mainstream or without opposition. Local Mayor Emma Kerr, a former Belgian Socialist Party member, expelled for contact with the Turkish far-right and accused of denial of the Armenian genocide, tried to ban it. That was wrong. The Belgian government eventually overturned his decision. Similarly, the German police breakup of a Palestinian Congress and denial of visas to some of the speakers is bad for freedom of speech and assembly. It also fuels a culture in Germany that makes discussion of Israel-Palestine difficult. In the California case, the ban has been entirely preemptive, and we cannot know what the student planned to say or whether her cited comments on social media were even relevant to her planned speech. Some of her posts on Instagram suggested she was for the abolition of the State of Israel. We would object and remonstrate, but a speech can be challenged in writing, meetings, and subsequent protests. A rule that harmful ideas must be suppressed depends entirely on who decides what's harmful, and even if the adjudicator is infallible, it is likely to work against the honest debate needed to dispel the ideas. Any measures used by the state, university authorities, and others can be used against leftist ideas just as easily. A selective approach to democratic rights, demanding them only for those who think something like us, is a pitfall for socialists. Reliance on rules that can be used to ban our speakers and ideas from being heard is short-sighted. Sometimes bourgeois states prefer to sweep demagogic right-wing ideas under the carpet rather than see a popular movement built to counter and dispel those ideas. Certainly, we want to build such a popular movement on a scale where the state will fear it. Our answer has to be to mobilize for our ideas first, to campaign, to convince. Alongside the mobilization, we can challenge the ideas of reactionaries by protesting at their rallies or, where appropriate, engaging and debating. If our goal is to convince people of the ideas of socialism, then we must seek to raise awareness, including knowledge of hostile ideas and confidence to combat them among many millions of people. That goal remains impossible if we think open ideological confrontation with right-wing ideas which remain current is undesirable, or fear a contest of ideas. Immediately, that means we must advocate for the fullest democratic rights for all groups. Short of fascists, where advocacy of ideas bleeds directly into immediate incitement to violence, the right of political ideas to be debated and heard should be protected. And even with fascists, we do not advocate extra police powers in the hope that those powers will be used only against fascists and not against us. Page 5. Germany. Push against 1871 abortion law. Women's Fight Back by Katie Dollar. A government-appointed expert commission in Germany has recommended legalizing abortion in the first trimester of pregnancy. Outside of exceptions for maternal health or rape, abortions in Germany are technically illegal. Very few people are prosecuted under the outdated law, para 218 of the Penal Code, dating from the unification of Germany, 1871. Germany's largest opposition party, the Conservative Christian Democrats, has warned it will challenge any attempts to change the status quo. After German reunification, the Supreme Court overturned an attempt to legalize abortion in 1993. The Commission said that legislators could also decriminalize second trimester abortions, but did not recommend it. Abortions from the 22nd week onwards should remain fundamentally illegal, but, quotes, do not necessarily have to be punishable, end quotes, the Commission said. Since 2003, the number of clinics providing abortions has fallen by more than 50%. Abortions are not part of the standard curriculum for gynecologists in Germany. Doctors trained earlier are retiring, and some are put off by anti-abortion activity at clinics. Telemedicine for abortion was introduced in 2021, and in 2002, the paragraph 219A of the Criminal Code Nazi-era legislation that made it illegal to advertise abortion services was abolished. Many hoped that this was the beginning of widespread changes in Germany's oddly backward abortion legislation. A bill is currently progressing through the Bundestag that, if passed, would outlaw the intimidation of staff and patients around abortion clinics and hospitals. But German press are now speculating that the Social Democratic Party, which leads the current governing coalition, may pause proposals as its coalition comes under strain. German Health Minister Karl Lauterbach, who became a household name as a public health expert in the pandemic, said the report's, quotes, scientific expertise is a major help in answering the complex ethical questions on reproductive self-determination and reproductive medicine. What we don't need in Germany is another debate that divides society, end quotes, the Social Democratic Minister added. The German right will certainly mobilize to prevent improvements of abortion law. The left must mobilize against the right and positively for reproduction freedoms. Scottish Labour passive as SNP declines, by Anne Fields. Just 2,000 people turned up to the 20 April pro-Scottish independence march in Glasgow. The Labour Party of Alex Salmond and Ash Regan did not mobilise for the event. Alba claims that it was not invited. Believe in Scotland, who organised the demonstration, claims that Alba was invited but did not respond. The Wings Over Scotland website, which continues to enjoy a very substantial following, not only failed to mobilise its supporters for the event but positively denounced it. Wings is involved in a full-scale war with the SNP and the Greens over trans rights. The attempt to boost numbers by grafting the Gaza conflict into the theme of the march, banners and placards including Zionism is racism and boycotts Israel and the now obligatory Stop the Genocide in Gaza of the Gaza Genocide Emergency Committee had only minimal success. In any case, the attempt to equate Scotland's relation to the UK with the Israel-Palestine conflict, chants included Freedom for Palestine, Freedom for Scotland, and Free from the River to the Sea, Palestine will be free. From the Islands to Dumfries, a Republic will be free, must count as peak political delirium. Chants of freedom for Ukraine and Ukrainian flags were entirely absent from the march. The internationalism of Scottish nationalism clearly has its limits. Believing in Scotland appears to be an alternative to believing in facts. According to the Green MSP and rally speaker Ross Greer, for example, quotes, we simply want to live in a democracy that allows us to make a decision. I'm more confident now than I've ever been that we are marching towards a day when our fate is in Scotland's hands, end quotes. But the people of Scotland made a democratic decision in the 2014 referendum to remain part of the UK. The 2014 referendum is certainly not binding for all time, but in the decade which has passed since then, support for independence has generally remained at about 45%, the same level of support as 2014. The turnout for the demonstration must have suffered from the fact that it was being held at the end of a disastrous week for the SNP and their Green junior partners in the Holyrood coalition governments. SNP Energy Secretary Marie McKellen had announced that the SNP Green Coalition was dumping its flagship policy of cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 75% by 2030. Peter Murrell, former SNP chief executive, a post he had held for 22 years, and husband of former SNP leader Nicola Sturgeon, had been rearrested and charged with having embezzled funds from the SNP. He has since resigned from the SNP. Figures have been released showing that just 3% of poor children in Scotland had been provided with a free bike, despite an SNP pledge that all children who could not afford one would get a free bike and a free laptop by 2026. Yet another delivery delay has been announced for the Calmec Glen Sunox ferry. Ferry services are a big issue in Scotland. The contract had been awarded in 2015 and a date of 2018 set for completion. It had been a particularly bad week for the SNP Greens. At the same time, it was no more than a continuation of the SNP's overall record. Its much vaunted 2021 NHS recovery plan has seen waiting lists continue to rise, and only three of the promised 10 national treatment centres have been delivered. Plans to create highly protected marine areas for 10% of Scottish coastal waters were dropped last year. So too was the introduction of the deposit return scheme for drinks containers, now pushing back to 2025 or even later. Since 2020, homelessness has increased year on year. Teacher numbers have likewise fallen year on year. £38 million earmarked for better terms and conditions for care workers has just been cut from the social care budget. And Scotland continues to suffer the highest rate of drug-related deaths in Europe. Going further back in time, the named person scheme was abandoned in 2019. The failed 2012 Offensive Behaviour at Football Act was repealed in 2018. And the SNP's promise of 2007 to scrap the council tax and replace it by a fairer system of local government finance has remained a dead letter for 17 years. The Scottish Greens have called an emergency general meeting to decide whether to remain in coalition with the SNP at Holyrood. As divisions within the SNP, Green coalition becomes more acute, although the Greens have too much to lose by pulling out of it, and the SNP staggers from one debacle to another. Scottish Labour's response is to mirror Labour's approach at national level. Just as Starmer relies on discontented Tory voters to put Labour into power, so too Scottish Labour relies on discontented SNP voters and Tory tactical voters to unseat SNP MPs in this year's general election. At neither Scottish nor national level is Labour offering a positive radical alternative which would enthuse in voters and rebuild a solid electoral base. The ongoing collapse of the SNP has not resulted in a collapse in support for Scottish independence, still running at about 45% in opinion polls. Demonstrations being organised by All Under One Banner over the summer months are likely to be much larger than 20th of April. At the 20th of April rally, Humza Yousaf asked the paltry attendants to believe in Scotland, but most SNP members appear not to believe in Humza Yousaf himself. Page 6. The Climate and Memorial Day, Environment by Stuart Jordan. For the first time, the International Trade Union Confederation has made the climate crisis the focus of International Workers' Memorial Day, 28th of April. The increased focus of the world's workplace safety reps on the climate crisis offers up a new and promising front in the struggle against climate change. Workplace safety reps have much to offer the environmental movement, with both our tools for identifying and controlling environmental risk and our experience in prosecuting effects of struggle. Since capitalism's earliest days, the exhaustion and maiming of workers has gone hand in hand with environmental destruction. But whereas environmental destruction has only been partially ameliorated by light touch regulation, the casual disregard for our health and safety has generated significant resistance. The long struggle for workplace safety has been one of the most powerful civilizing forces in capitalist history. Down the road from my workplace in East London stands the Bryant and May Match Factory. It is now a block of posh flats, but in the late 19th century, young women and girls were worked into an early grave there by 80 to 90 hours weeks and exposure to toxic chemicals that left them facially disfigured and often dead. The reason children are no longer facially disfigured in sweet shops in Britain is due entirely to the long struggle for workplace safety and, crucially, safety reps who have done the patient work of organising collective refusal of unsafe work. The capitalist class have fought us every step of the way, and what we have gained in terms of working class life expectancy and reasonable working conditions has been achieved despite their best efforts. In Britain, the collective wisdom of this long struggle for workplace safety was codified in law in the Health and Safety at Work Act 1974. Alongside the NHS and welfare state, that act is perhaps the greatest achievement of the British labour movement. It gives every worker a legal right to healthy and safe work and the tools to organise to make that happen, including the legal right to paid time off to organise around workplace safety. Any ecologically minded worker can use those rights to organise around environmental issues at work. The role of a safety rep is to identify risk in the workplace environment and then apply the hierarchy of controls to identify how that risk can be minimised. The hierarchy of controls states that the most effective means of controlling a risk is elimination, and the least effective is personal protective equipment. If a hazard has been eliminated from your environment, then it cannot harm you, but you are having to use PPE. If you are having to use PPE, then it is because the hazard is near at hand that instant. Generally, the measures that are further up the hierarchy of control are the most costly to the capitalist class and the hardest to win. Elimination of a risk is often often involves considering the factors that extend well beyond the workplace. But by the same logic, the HSW Act allows individual workers who are conscious of the threats posed by climate change to step up and make a real difference. Even a single workplace safety rep can win immediate improvements to their workplace by simple force of argument. But the more workers who set up to become safety reps and start organising around those issues, the more potential for building the movement we need to win a livable future. Workplace health and safety provides a way of linking immediate adaptations, PPE, engineering controls, etc., to the wider fight for social control of the means of production so we can organise the just transition that we need, elimination. As the climate crisis escalates, the struggle, like so many workplace safety struggles before, it will be one in which we are fighting for our lives. Remember the dead, fight for the living. Third Period, First Republic and Symbols, by Eric Lee, founder editor of Labour Start, writing here in a personal opinion column. Rough sleepers have returned to Finsbury Park, and their various belongings lie pressed against the walls of a railway bridge. Just above where they sleep, the walls are plastered with posters asking, "Are you a communist?" The posters are the work of the newly formed Revolutionary Communist Party, a group formerly known as Socialist Appeal, which comes out of a Trotskyist tradition. But the iconography of the posters tells a different story, with a large hammer and a sickle logo, as well as crude slogans denouncing the media. These seem to come from the Stalinist wing of the international communist movement. In fact, in both design and message, they refer to a specific period beginning in 1928, when the Communist International made a sharp sectarian turn to the left. It was known as the Third Period. It is an odd choice for a non-Stalinist political group to make, and my guess is that they are doing so because they think that there is a market for this message among very young people who have no personal memory of the Cold War or of Stalinism. There is a strange symmetry between this and what is happening today in the streets of Tbilisi, Georgia. There, the pro-Russian ruling party, Georgian Dream, has again introduced legislation to expose civil society organizations who are to be branded as foreign agents if they received money from non-Georgian sources. The legislation is very unpopular and was withdrawn last year due to mass protests. This year, I noticed one thing I hadn't seen before. Some of the protesters are carrying banners with the flag of the First Georgian Republic, 1918 to 1921. When Georgia declared its independence from the Soviet Union in 1991, it adopted that flag. But after years of political turmoil and civil war, a new flag took its place. The blood-red revolutionary banner of the Georgian Social Democrats was displaced. The new flag focuses on the country's Christian faith instead. But now the old flag appears to be back. Some protesters were even carrying newly minted versions of the same flag. Some students were swearing to fight for Georgia's independence in front of it. I asked some friends in Georgia what was going on. As one person put it, quotes, "The old flag has been seen as a revival among youth recently as a symbol of the Republic," end quotes. Another correspondent told me, quotes, "When I used to use the National Library reading room for work, it was absolutely full of young students poring over periodicals and newspapers from the First Republic. As they are too young to have any negative associations with the flag from the 1990s, it's definitely something cool and exciting to them as a symbol of sovereignty and independence against seemingly impossible odds," end quotes. As one person summed it up, quotes, "There are good historians that brought the discussions of the First Republic back to the table, and they are so relevant and thrilling that people get hooked," end quotes. Words and symbols have meanings, and those meanings are defined by their actual use. In the last century, the word communist and the hammer and sickle logo came to be associated with a brutal totalitarianism regime, not only in the Soviet Union, but in China, North Korea, Cuba, and elsewhere. If the leaders of Britain's Revolutionary Communist Party are betting on a new generation knowing nothing at all about this, then what they are doing is the worst kind of cynical manipulation. The situation in Tbilisi is the exact opposite. A generation of young people is growing up learning for the first time the real history of their country, especially during the first years of the 20th century. They are fascinated by what they have learnt and have revived a symbol of that time, a symbol of an independent Georgia, one dominated by social democrats, and they are using the symbol to fight for a different future. I hope that they win. Page 7, Stop the Rwanda Scheme by Ben Taus. As of late April, the Conservative government's bill declaring Rwanda a safe country to deport refugees is stuck, bouncing between the House of Commons and the Lords. More than once, the Lords have made amendments attempting to moderate aspects of the government's outrageous plan. The government, via its Commons majority, has rejected almost all amendments. On 17th of April, the Lords sent the bill back with two amendments establishing an independent monitoring panel to assess safety of Rwanda and exempting Afghans seeking asylum here after having to flee the Taliban due to their prior work as translators for the British military. By the time you read this, the government's MPs will likely have voted these down and sent the bill back again. The bill follows the Supreme Court's judgment last November that Rwanda is not a safe place to send refugees and is liable to send them onwards to countries where they are at risk. The government's response is legislation saying that courts must consider Rwanda safe no matter the evidence. A further hurdle for the government is finding an airline for the deportation flights. Even Rwanda's state-owned airline refuses. Another airline, Air Tanker, is reportedly in negotiations. NGO Freedom from Torture has organized a mass write-in. And if aviation workers refuse to lift off with deportees on board, Tory ministers can hardly fly the planes themselves. German aviation workers have blocked hundreds of deportations this way. Before the UK deal with Rwanda, the brutal M23 militia operating in the Democratic Republic of Congo, backed and supplied by Rwanda, had receded for nearly a decade when countries, including the UK, threatened to pull aid from Rwanda. Shortly after the UK struck this new deal with Rwanda, N23, it re-entered the fray in the eastern DRC. Since then, the militia has committed multiple atrocities against civilians and displaced nearly 1 million people. The former Rwandan military has even crossed the border to assist M23 assaults. The spectre of open Rwanda-DRC war looms. As a Byline Times investigation highlighted, other states have called on Rwanda to stop, but the UK has remained pointedly silent and has paid the Rwandan government £250 million. NUS Conference, an Undemocratic Shambles by Sam Myerson. At the National Union of Students NUS Conference on the 17th to the 18th of April, the chief debate was on reform, a suite of further undemocratic changes, including an end to the formal scrutiny process and an end to delegate elections. Already little time is given over to real policy discussions. There is no voting in person, it's all online after conference, and no formal route for amendments to be submitted. The NUS leadership and staff must have been concerned about the chance that their reform plans will not pass. Two further extraordinary sessions have been called for Monday and Tuesday, 22nd and 23rd of April, for delegates to be informed of the proposed changes. No other policy area or dissenting voice gets extra time. Besides reform, the other big discussions at the conference was on Gaza, and that went badly. We heard the word Zios and the sentiment "kick the Zionists out" repeatedly during the 2 days. Graffiti appeared in one of the toilet cubicles saying "fuck Zios," accompanied by a blue swastika. NUS had invited the educational charities Solutions Not Sides, SNS, and Peril Histories, PH, to provide information on the conflict, some students staged a demonstration calling for SNS and PH to be kicked out of conference and even for the Union of Jewish Students, UJS, to be removed from conference on grounds of UJS being a, quote, Zionist organization that normalizes genocide and doesn't represent all Jews, end quotes. An amendment to the Palestinian motion had originally demanded that NUS campaign for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. After procedural objections, that was changed to say NUS should provide resources to assist students who wish to campaign on BDS and against prevent. Time given to debate was very short, and we could not get called to speak against BDS. We were the only revolutionary socialist group organized at conference, and the only group on the left, unless you count the Labour Party, with an explicit presence, and our bulletin went down well. Wandsworth Prison Campaign launched by Mohan Sen. The Wandsworth Prison Improvement Campaign says it had 250 people at its first public meeting on 10th of April. The campaign reports the audience included ex-prisoners and parents of prisoners. A leading figure in the campaign is the prisoner's former Quaker chaplain, sacked last year essentially for being too soft on prisoners. HMP Wandsworth in southwest London houses over 1,500 prisoners. It is the fifth biggest prison in Britain. The campaign's demands are revealing. 1. Prisoners to get medication and attend hospital appointments. 2. A plan to deal with rats, pigeons and cockroaches. 3. Ensure hot water, heating and flushing toilets. 4. Access to clothes, underwear, laundry and showers. 5. Easy and regular access to books. In the last 30 years, the UK's population has grown 15%. The UK prison population near doubled to 83,000. Official figures project this will increase to near 100,000 by mid-2026. Shadow Prisons Minister Ruth Cadbury was at the 10th April meeting there, and on TV she attacked the Tories. But Labour is not promising more resources to address the dire situation for prisoners, let alone questioning the number in prisons or the wider framework of carceral justice. Pages 8 to 10. The What, Who and Why of Socialism by Sean McGamma. Quotes. It is necessary to find the particular link in the chain which must be grasped with all our strength in order to keep the whole chain in place and prepare to move on resolutely to the next link, end quotes, by Vladimir Ulyanov Lenin. In the 21st century, the state of the world testifies to the truth that working-class socialism is not only a good idea but a stark necessity for humankind. Capitalism is still a system of waste, irrationality, and savage inhumanity. Wage slavery and exploitation are at the heart and root of capitalism. Every year, tens of millions of third world children die needlessly and horribly under this system, ruled by bankers, factory owners, billionaires, and self-righteous media magnates. Socialism is necessary. Yet the credibility of socialism is buried under the debris of Stalinism. That Stalinism was the socialism that failed, is now the conventional wisdom of people who know neither socialism nor Stalinism. The idea of socialism, the ideas of socialism are at a nadir of influence and prestige. Socialism is reduced to a vague word. Most people haven't a clue what real socialism is about or what it would look like. In Britain, the best fruits of reform socialism, the health service and the welfare state, are in ruins. In many countries, working class organisations now have less weight and are less self-confident than they were in the decades when they forced welfare and other reforms in the bourgeoisie. In Britain, the labour movement, without which socialism can never be more than good ideas, bears the scars and mutilations of structural changes in industry and employment forced through on the bosses' terms. History tells us that the working class and its movements are repeatedly made, remade, and made over yet again by the never-ending changes in capitalist production and technology, and by the outcome of the struggles between labour and capital. The working class pays dearly for mischances and defeats. The working class movement is forced again and again to resurrect, remake, and redefine itself. To keep their bearings, its militants are forced to probe the past for lessons, parallels, examples, and precedents. The socialists are the memory of the class, the curators of its historical experiences, and the harbingers of revival. Nothing is more obvious than that the duty of socialists, those who are worth anything, now is to go to the working class and into the working class movements to help organize, reorganize, and regenerate it, and to plant the seeds of unfalsified socialism once more, especially amongst the youth. Yet this work is scarcely being done. The space that should be occupied by serious Marxist socialists doing this work is filled instead by a raucous tribe of middle-class sects. A vastly destructive polarization exists between the concerns of reform socialists and labour movement activists on one side and would-be revolutionary socialists on the other. The polarization is psychologically a natural tendency. If it had not been overcome in the past, then the mass socialist labour movements would never have been built. Is the Marxist view of revolution counterposed to the basic labour movement commitment to parliamentary democracy? No, it is not. Socialism is not possible until the mass of workers want it and are prepared to realise it. Neither is an extension of democracy beyond the level already attained. It is in the direct interests of the working class to defend the existing system against anti-democratic attacks. It is in our interest to extend it and better it. Marxists have much more in common with people in the labour movement whose best notion of democracy is parliamentary democracy. We are faced with rebuilding socialism almost from the ground up, and with rebuilding, regenerating, and politically rearming the labour movement. Agitate, educate, organise. What we do was long ago summed up in these three words: agitate, educate, organise. You will find those three words, agitate, educate, organise, emblazoned on labour movement banners. You will find them in the files of old socialist newspapers, decades after decade, back for nearly 200 years. You will find them spread in socialist literature across the world, in the writings of the Russian Marxists, Lenin, for example. These words sum up what a socialist does and what socialist organizations exist to do. What do they mean? Take them one at a time. Agitate means to move, to stir up. It means that you object to the way people are treated and that you urge them to fight back, that you expose and show up in detail the human meaning of capitalist exploitation, oppression, and indifference, that you expose and bring to light conditions of factories, offices, colleges, housing estates, that you expose the brutalities and injustice of the police and the law courts, and that you point out the exploitation and corruption at the heart of the capitalist economic system on which all our lives depend. It means, in short, that you, as a socialist, hold a mirror up to the world around you, draw people's attention to the details of capitalist exploitation and oppression, show them their situation and urge them to act. You stir them up. You tell them not to accept this state of affairs. You move things out of the congealed social inertia that holds the capitalist wage slave system in place. But don't people already know their own situation? Don't they know that they are badly treated and oppressed? Of course they do. They know it in the pores of their daily lives. They feel it minute by minute, doing jobs that do not interest them, when they are driven into degrading drudgery for money which too often does not even buy them all they need, when they are forced to live on the dole or made homeless and forced onto the streets, when they experience the countless grades and degrees of humiliation and exploitation that working class people must endure. Of course they know. Protest. But it is not as simple as that. People get used to terrible conditions, even when they directly experience them as terrible. Things are now accepted in Britain that would not so long ago have provoked outrage and spurred the labour movement into vigorous action to end them. The shout of anger, protest, outrage, even if for the moment it changes little, is a greater force in human life. It is written in our history. One of the most important strikes in British working class history was the famous Match Girls strike at Bryant and May's works in the East End of London in 1888. It was the start of mass trade unionism. It was sparked by agitation. Annie Besant wrote an account of the conditions in which the women worked, producing matches of their poverty, their exploitation, and the terrible diseases they contracted working with sulphur without protection. Reading Besant's account of their own lives, these women were spurred into action. Their strike was the first of a wave of strikes. The following year, the London Dockers' strike, that led to the creation of the great general trade unions, that is, to the creation of the modern labour movement and, indirectly, of the Labour Party. The women had suffered for years. They had seen their sisters sicken and die from sulphur poisoning. Of course they knew all about their own conditions. They had experienced what Besant wrote about and knew it in a way that Besant could never know it, page 9. But the mirror held up by Besant's articles sharpened their perception, clarified the ways they saw their conditions, and let them see their lives through the eyes of someone coming fresh upon conditions to which they had to grow accustomed. They were stirred up, agitated. Just as in the personal quarrel or conflicts of opinion, you can be vastly strengthened in your situation, feeling or conviction by a friendly voice of agreement. So also workers who already feel oppressed and can be roused by agitation to do something about it. They can be shown their conditions starkly and freshly by comparison with others more fortunate. They can be encouraged by a show of anger to raise their own voices. Agitation can free them from the hypnosis of familiarity, the submissions generated by hopelessness, and the instability to see an alternative life, even if only a slightly better one. Experiences are like the match women's strike are likely to be repeated in Britain today, when traditional trade unionism has been uprooted across large swathes of industry to make way for casual working and very intense exploitation. The agitating socialist is the probing, implacable accuser and prosecutor of capitalism as it impinges on particular lives and specific groups of people, in the first place before its victims, our class. As James Connolly once defines this work of ours, quotes, "The men and women of your class, show them their wrongs and yours. Plant in their hearts that hatred deep that suffers and endures," end quotes. To rouse, agitate people into action, even for a small change or a petty reform, is to help them start down the road to outright opposition to capitalist capital and all of all its works. Educate. Rosa Luxemburg explained, quotes, can the socialist be against reform? Can we counterpose the social revolution, the transformation of the existing order, our final goal to social reforms? Certainly not. The daily struggle for reforms, for the amelioration of the conditions of the workers within the framework of the existing social order, and for democratic institutions, offers to the socialists the only means of engaging in the proletarian class war and working in the direction of the final goal, the conquest of political power and the suppression of wage labour. Between social reform and revolution, there is then the socialist, for the socialists, an indissoluble tie. End quotes. Take the second big word, educate. What is education? Agitation is education, but it is not rounded, deep, broad education, and that education is needed too. For socialism, as distinct from trade unionism, it is irreplaceable. To urge revolts against particular conditions is good. Hatred of the conditions which add up to much of the reality of working class life under capitalism, that is the beginning of wisdom for the socialists themselves. If they lack that hatred, if they let it fade, if they do not keep in their minds all the time the better details of the capitalist reality, then they themselves will soon wither and die as socialists. Overview. Yet it is not enough. It is also necessary to understand why things are as they are, how and why capitalism oppresses people. For this you must educate yourself and educate others, who will then educate yet others. Workers react against particular outrages. They fight, they strike, demonstrate, lobby MPs. They feel burning indignation. But unless they are educated to see how their concern, what agitates them, fits into the whole capitalist system, and educated too to see capitalism for what it is, a temporary phase in history, then they will never go beyond blind reaction to this or that aspect of capitalism. No matter how violent and spectacular the reactions might be, it cannot change society fundamentally, even where it wins partial concessions. The workers will get what they want, or fail to get it, or get some of it, and that perhaps only temporarily. They will never understand the whole system that way. They will never fight capitalism or as capitalism in all its aspects, but only in one or and analogous situations. And they will never fight to replace it. Militants in one cause will not make the connection between their concerns and the concerns of others, of the oppressed. They will not become socialists. Without rounded socialist education, all the agitation in the world will not change capitalism or replace it. Blind agitation in particular issues, separated off from other agitation and integrated into a coherent outlook on the world, can even strengthen capitalism by pitting one group of disaffected people against another. Most people involved in direct action of the sort that occurs spontaneously and which we try by agitation to evoke, tragically never attain any anti-capitalist overview. It is the job of socialist education to help them develop such an overview. Socialist education is necessary not only to help workers make sense of the overall position, but also to help militants avoid what is often the nonsensical picture they would get by extrapolating from immediate impressions. It is not enough to urge people to be guided by more by mere instinct, by such rules of thumb as siding with the oppressed, opposing what the ruling class wants, supporting militancy and being sympathetic to our rulers' enemies. Of course you should side with the oppressed. Quotes, impartiality is between strong and the weak, as between strong and the weak is the virtue of the slave, end quotes. But what does it mean to side with oppressed people? Do you adopt their views? But their views may be, and usually are, sectional, one-sided and narrow-minded, or even blindly self-centered and chauvinist. For example, the Palestinian Arabs are oppressed. History has dealt with them very harshly, and in general, the socialists should support them. But for decades, their leaders proposed a solution to their conditions based on destroying the state of Israel and subjugating its Jewish inhabitants, or killing them or driving them out. That was to be done by the surrounding Arab states. Until the late 1960s, this was expressed in the crudest terms by the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO, leader Ahmed Shukari. Quotes, drive the Jews into the sea, end quotes. Thereafter, it was proposed in the disguised form of calling on Israel to abolish itself and cede its territory to a new Arab state of Palestine, in which the Jews were to be guaranteed religious but not national rights. They too could only be achieved by Arab subjugation and conquest, but it sounded better. It was in fact an Arab chauvinist program, and in the circumstances so unrealistic that it helped Israel's chauvinists isolate the Palestinians for decades. Whatever that position did, it did not serve the interests of the Palestinian people. Now the slogan, "From the River to the Sea," offers the same answer, disguised from the river to the sea, without Jews or with Jews suppressed. We in the AWL advocate two states for the two peoples living in the area, as the PLO has done since 1988. The point is that without all-round socialist education in the history of the conflicts and in the general principles and politics which Marxists bring to bear in all such conflicts, consistent democracy and compromise, where the conflict is one of right as against right, you could not make sense of these issues. You could not arrive at rational solutions. To endorse the old PLO program, because it was the program of the oppressed, would have been to substitute other concerns and principles for socialist and democratic concerns and principles. Many socialists, including ourselves for a time, did exactly that. Knee-jerk. The same follows for all the other crude rules of thumb. Support militancy? Yes, but the most militant in a national or communal conflict are likely to be the reckless chauvinists. Side against the ruling class? Yes, but if we just say yes when the ruling class says no, and when it says yes, then and no one says yes, then we surrender all independence, page 10, and become a negative imprint of the ruling class. We abandoned all objectivity and all attempts at an independent working class outlook in the world. We implicitly surrender the fight for working class independence. For example, large sections of the British left responded to the fact of European semi-unity organized by the capitalists with knee-jerk slogans like Britain out, no to the European Union, when they should instead have been fomenting cross-Europe unity of the working class. The attribute of these sections of the left, and by Jeremy Corbyn's close circle, did much to win Brexit, a great reactionary movement by Britain. All-round Marxist education is as essential as the independent working class outlook it helps produce. What about the third big word, organize? So we expose, pillory, and point the finger of accusation at the horrors of life under capitalism and the missed chances for a better, more civilized collective life. So we educate young people and militants into a rounded view of society, fitting the things we denounce into the whole picture of capitalism and fitting capitalism itself into a conception of history and the role of the working class in history. We urge the need to overthrow capitalism and replace it with socialism. What then? We urge people to organize alongside us to achieve these things. Without organization, the rest is diffuse, incomplete, and likely to be without lasting consequence. Organize debate. Socialists organize on many levels. We organize trade unions that fight to get the best price for our labor power. We organize for specific goals in society, in the Labour Party and in the unions. For example, to defend the welfare state or fight for free trade unions. We organize the rank and file for trade union democracy. We organize ourselves, the hardcore socialists, in our own organization. Workers' Liberty, the industrial bulletins Workers' Liberty supporters produce, and our paper Solidarity are the means by which we organize or help organize these things. So are meetings, pickets, demonstrations. Persuasion, discussion, and debate are the essential tools of socialism. Without them, without dialogue and debate, the left will never advance beyond its present tragic fragmentation. Free debate is essential. The left itself is still marked by the scars of Stalinist Ice Age. We live in a world where the left, after so many decades of Stalinism and after so many defeats, is in a condition of corruption and decay. So we must regenerate the left by way of honest debate and polemic. The precondition for effective socialist activity is the existence of a distinct working class world outlook. This has not only to be propagated, it has to be tested against reality and developed in line with reality. Our socialist movement is first of all a movement of ideas, proposals, memory and perspective of history. That is why the polemic and discussion element in Solidarity is irreplaceable for our work. What we argue for in the working class movement and the ideas in which we educate those who respond to our agitation are not entirely given and fixed in advance. They are never frozen or finished. Not everything is known or can be known. Marx died 150 years ago, Trotsky over 80 years ago. An essential part of the work socialists do is to keep reality under review, to register, discuss and assess new things in society and in the continuing experience of our class. We argue our views as sharply as we think necessary. While advocating left unity in action, we debate with other socialists, but we aspire to be neither popes, cardinals, nor the one true church of the left. Solidarity is not a closed monopoly, but an open vehicle for honest and free discussion. We organize ourselves as tightly as necessary, but all our work is aimed ultimately at serving the broad movement of our class. We have no special interests apart from the working class, as the Communist Manifesto said in 1848. We teach the working class and try to be a memory of the class, and we also learn from the working class and codify that learning. Thus, we work to prepare the future by fighting in the struggles of the working class now and by socialist education. We are, we believe, the bearers of a socialist culture and of a Marxist outlook on the world, and therefore we believe that our paper, like our work in general, is of great importance for the future of the labour movement. In a letter appealing to a Spanish anarchist trade union to join the Communist International in 1919, the chairman of the International, Gregory Zinoviev, said, If we miss the chance at overthrowing capitalism, it may go now and not come again for decades. He was absolutely right. The chance was missed. Now is not 1919, but major turning points will come, and maybe soon. Our work, we hope, will help ensure that fewer chances are missed and help speed the revival of a clear-cut working-class revolutionary socialism untainted by Stalinism, reformism, or the sectarianism and cultism that deform most of neo-Trotskyist tendencies. Russian Revolution and Stalinism. Something else has happened to Marxism. Its militants call themselves scientific socialists, as distinct from utopian and romantic socialists. They did that because their socialism was rooted in the evolution of society, in the growth of capitalism itself, in its tendency to concentration and socialization of the means of production, and in its potential for abundance in the basic things of life. For the first time since humankind swung down from the trees, we can abolish the scarcity which has governed human society all through our long history. Socialism was more than good ideas that could be applied at any time in history and to any society in our history. Socialism was necessarily the product of advanced capitalism and could not be produced on the basis of less than that. Friedrich Engels called this the, quotes, the invading socialist society, end quotes. Action by the working class, the socialist revolution, would mark the transition to the different system, socialism, with more or less working class violence dependent on ruling class resistance. The working class could, and in Russia in 1917, did take power in countries that were far from ripe for the transition to socialism. But then one of two things would happen. Either the revolution would spread in a matter of months or a few years to countries that were ripe for socialism, the Bolsheviks had Germany in mind, or all the old crap, as Marxist pungently put it, would recur and resume. The struggle within scarcity to become part of the privileged upper class, to win a higher place in the division of the surplus products. Stalinism and developmentalism. In Germany and other social democracies, the German and other social democracies left the Russian Revolution in isolation. All the old crap reemerged in the form of bureaucratization. The idea forced on the Bolsheviks by circumstances held on until the countries ripe for socialism come to our rescue, was abandoned formally with Stalin's declaration of socialism in one country in December 1924. Quotes, the victory of socialism in one country, even if that country is less developed in the capitalist sense, is quite possible and probable, end quotes. The business of the Bolsheviks and their Stalinist successors retaining power was now to oversee the development of Russia, to do what the bourgeoisie had done in the capitalist development of Europe and elsewhere towards the possibility of socialism. All the victories of Stalinism thereafter were in backward societies, with the exception of Czechoslovakia and possibly East Germany. China in 1949, when the Mao Stalinists took over, was more underdeveloped than Russia had been in 1917. Meanwhile, the Social Democrats everywhere, even when they were seriously for reform, as in 1945 and after in Britain, the Labour Party was, did not see socialism as separate from capitalism or a system of workers' power. For the Stalinist states and in the non-ruling Stalinist parties, socialism turned into developmentalism. The task of socialists was not, as in Marx, to usher in the socialist revolution in conditions made right by capitalist development, but to develop societies industrially, as in Marxist theory, the bourgeoisie had. And as Trotsky said, the bureaucracy made a, quotes, concerted effort to present its struggle against the petty bourgeoisie for the surplus products and for power as a struggle against capitalists' restoration. The Social Democrats ceased to advocate socialism as something distinct from capitalism and used the Stalinist horrors as reason for supporting the bourgeoisie. Michael Foote, then Labour leader, rebuked the Marxist left in January 1982 as failing to learn from, quotes, half a century of tumult and terror in human affairs, end quotes, which had been a, quotes, direct refutation of apocalyptic Marxism, end quotes, meaning the Stalinist revolution. The socialism the Stalinists practiced, or in capitalist countries, summons people to rally for with such development of society as the bourgeoisie had won or tried to win where they ruled. It was a competing alternative system that did not come from capitalism or from the wage slave class of capitalism, the proletariat, but from outside capitalism. Bureaucrats, relying on force and state power, tried to develop tried to develop societies which were not always ripe even for capitalism. In the Communist Manifesto, the founders of the scientific socialism sang a hymn of praise for the transformation of the world which the bourgeoisie had wrought. What we see now in China, where what is effectively capitalism has replaced bureaucratic rule in industry, is what Marx and Engels praised for creating the preconditions for socialism, not socialism itself. What was denoted socialism by Stalinists and those they influenced was really developmentalism, or bureaucratic developmentalism, misnamed as socialism, or by orthodox Trotskyist defensists as the first stage, defined by a nationalized industry, etc., towards socialism. They let the Stalinists define their worlds for them. Socialism, Marxist socialism, socialism as we understand it, will revive, but not of itself. It needs the work for socialism of convinced socialists, an intense drive for it. It needs people who devote to it not only their spare evenings, we want those too, but their whole active, persevering, endeavouring, purposeful lives. Pages 11 and 12. Russia's Revolutionaries in the 1890s by Sean McGanner. 10th in a series of articles around the 100th anniversary of the death of Vladimir Ulyanov Lenin. The Tsar Liberator, Alexander II, was in the eve of his death in March 1881 at the hands of the Narodnaya Volya, people's will, populists, ready to make some concessions to the reform-minded liberals. The work of Narodnaya Volya assassins put an end to return from above for a generation. In the 1880s and 90s, the Tsarist regime was a frozen ice cap on top of Russian society. But underneath that inert political regime, Russian capitalism expanded. Market relations became dominant in more and more of Russian life. The working class grew with the growth of industry. Great congregations of proletarians were created around the giant factories that were set up, importing the most advanced technology of the West, and sometimes on the basis of Western finance. A large part of the working class was still half peasant, retaining links to the countryside and often retaining control of some peasant's landholding. Many workers lived in barracks attached to the factories, in the way many Chinese workers do now. There was often a deep cleavage between the different segments of the working class. The metal workers were unusually more fixed than the cotton workers in the proletariat condition of having only the sale of their labour power to live on. Moreover, theirs was skilled labour. The cotton workers were less skilled and still half peasants, often only temporary visitors from the countryside. Sporadic revolts in the form of strikes and sometimes destruction of workplaces and machinery still occasionally broke out, but working class action was becoming less sporadic, more purposeful and more rational. A real working class was being created, and slowly a real working class movement emerged. Some critics of politically conscious workers existed in a more or less continually back to the great days of the populists. Unbroken continuity back to the great days of the populists. The exiled Marxist splinter group from populism, the Group for the Emancipation of Labour, Plekhanov, Axelrod, Sasulich, Deutsch, produced great works of theory and propaganda in the 1880s. Georgi Plekhanov settled theoretical accounts with populism in Our Differences, 1885. Inside Russia, Marxism at first existed only in the eclectic, diluted, and adulterated forms in which it could sustain the idea of traditional populism, that the village commune holding land in common, the obshchina, could be the basis of a special sort of agrarian socialism in Russia, and to the degree that the Marxist critique of capitalism was used to bolster this defining idea of the populists. What the consistent Marxists in the first place, Plekhanov, argued was that capitalism had already advanced to dominance in Russian life in the two decades after the end of serfdom in 1861, and therefore the central defining belief of the populists was now entirely utopian and indeed reactionary. The village commune was far gone in disintegration. Socialism in Russia could come only through the development of capitalism and as the creation of the Russian working class. Plekhanov and Axelrod retained some of the beliefs that they had held as populists. They thought that the bourgeois democratic revolution, the clearing of the ground for full capitalist development and the creation of a democratic republic, would, because of the weakness of the Russian bourgeoisie, have to be led by the Russian proletariat. Plekhanov told the 1889 founding conference of the Socialist Second International that the Russian Revolution would be led by the working class, or else it could not happen at all. But that remains a vague, unconcretized general idea. What it meant or might mean would be the substance of much of the pre-1917 discussion among Russian Marxists. Plekhanov himself would come to think that the revolution, being a bourgeois revolution, could be only led by the bourgeoisie. Different answers to the dilemmas posed would be the primary dividing line between the future Bolsheviks, the Mensheviks, and Trotsky, who developed a distinct variant of the idea Plekhanov and the Group for the Emancipation of Labour propounded in the 1880s. Populism continued despite Soviet persecution, but mainly as a tradition and in the fragmented activity of mostly student local populist circles, some of which included proletarians. The works of Marx were circulated, Wage, Labour and Capital, and Capital, whose first translated publication was in Russian in 1872, and discussed in the circles. The quotient of Marxism in the populist mixture taught in the circles gradually increased. Those who were more Marxist coexisted peacefully in those circles with those who were more populist until the onslaught of populist ideas by such Marxists as Piotr Struve got underway in 1894 and after. It was only then that a sharp polarization occurred. There are recorded examples of working class consumers in education circles deciding that they wanted Marxism and not populism taught. Some of the populist teachers complied and thereafter taught only Marx. And the working class continued to grow. The political impotence of populism, even at its point of greatest victory, when populist kills the Tsar, led after 1881 to decline and then to a discrediting. The diluted legal populism, evolutionary rather than revolutionary, became a force among the intelligentsia. The decisive turning point into a new era occurred in 1891-92 when famine swept across parts of Russia. It was the indirect consequence of the change in the peasant economy which the Tsarist ministers had orchestrated from the pinnacles of the state power when their demands for money taxes compelled the peasants to sell their grain and rely on buying some of it back later as food. As starvation stalked part of the empire, the state was unable to cope. Having stifled civil society for over a decade, the Tsarist autocracy now evoked private activity as a matter of urgency. It appealed to private citizens to help the people of the stricken areas. There was a large response. In something resembling the intelligentsia's going to the people in the mid-1870s, large numbers of educated men and women from the towns went into the countryside, this time not to educate the muzhiks or call on them to revolt, but to bring them food money collected in the towns to buy food and rudimentary medical care. The newly awakened intelligentsia's response to the passivity with which the peasantry suffered starvation and disease could have been big political consequences, would have been big political consequences, as had their experience with the peasantry in the 1870s. It radically discredited and helped finally bury the whole idea that the peasants could be any sort of Russian remaking revolutionary class. And as that was happening, the industrial working class, augmented enormously since populism's great days, and already possessing a layer of workers educated in their circles, began spectacularly to revolt. The revolutionary peasantry is dead. Long live the revolutionary proletariat. It was the same pattern that in the late 1870s had led populists like Plekhanov to turn to the working class, even when in their theory the peasantry was the decisive revolutionary class. But now it was on a far greater scale, and now the fundamentals of populism were widely seen as untenable, and there was now in existence and, so to speak, fully transported by Plekhanov into Russia a Marxist alternative revolutionary theory for them to turn to. Following on the lessons they drew from the passive suffering of the starving, disease hits muzhiks, the rise of the working class drove home to the socialist intelligentsia in life and no longer only in theory, the centrality of the Russian working class in any Russian revolution. At first, it was the workers in Poland and Lithuania at the western ends of the Tsarist Empire who moved in a wave of strikes and created an underground working class organization. The Jewish workers, mainly handicraft workers, created a fully developed underground labor movement. Then in the mid-1890s, the workers' strike movement spread across Russia, despite the fact that police terror there was more severe than in the western regions. In 1896-97, the St. Petersburg workers organized a series of mass strikes. From that point onwards, there was a mass underground Russian workers' movement manifesting itself in tremendous combativity. By 1901, the workers were bursting out into spontaneous political street demonstrations, page 11. The decline of populists' credibility, the positive proof given by the revolts that the industrial workers were the revolutionary class in Russia, the reawakening of the intelligentsia by the 1891-92 famine relief movement, and the intellectual preeminence of the Marxism of the group for the emancipation of labour and of a new generation of Marxists based in Russia, such as Struve, Tugin, Baranovsky and Lenin, now led to a proliferation of Marxist circles across Russia, both worker and intellectual. The workers and intellectuals had their own distinct and separate circles. Already in the 1890s, the sort of underground Marxist party that only emerged after the turn of the century was objectively possible, had the Marxists been politically experienced enough. The proliferation of Marxist circles across urban Russia already amounted to the rough outlines in Russian life of such a party, its prefiguration, so to speak. Up to the mid-1890s, the Marxist circles had engaged in heavy-duty propaganda and education, giving the small numbers of workers involved in them a pretty thorough education over the long period of time. The Jewish workers in the Pale, the area in the West to which Jews were largely confined, pioneered a new method, agitation. The Jews had a culture of their own, and as doubly and trebly expressed people, oppressed people, knew that Tsarism was no friend of theirs. Breaking away from exclusive reliance on the intensive study work of the old circles, socialists agitated among the workers on limited issues concerning their immediate interests, wages and conditions in the workshops. There was in this turn, again, an echo of the past. It was the same pattern as the turn of the intelligentsia of the 1870s, from the broad general educational work associated with the name of the populist writer Peter Lavrov, to agitating with the peasants in the question of dividing the landlord's land, calling them to immediate revolt, the period associated with the name of Bakunin. Whereas the agitation for immediate interests evoked no more response from the peasants than had the general education and propaganda of the first period of the intellectuals going to the people, the turn to agitation by the social democrats, as Marxists then called themselves, was immediately a stupendous success. It was what Plekhanov and others had already experienced in the late 1870s, when it was workers and not peasants who answered their call to action. Only now it was on a large and seemingly ever-growing scale. Arkada Kremer, one of the leaders of the turn to agitation in the Jewish Pale, now wrote a pamphlet on agitation to it. Both Kremer and fleetingly Martov would be founders of the Jewish socialist movement, the Bund. The pamphlet was circulated to and by the Marxist circles throughout Russia. Everywhere the Marxists turned to agitation, they found a tremendous response from the working class. In St. Petersburg in 1896-97, a city Marxist organization, the St. Petersburg League of Struggle, which included Lenin and the future Menshevik Martov, engaged in agitation directed to factory workers with immense success. It's important to stress that by now a workers' movement existed, circles in factories, which did not depend on stimulation by circles of the intelligentsia, though the workers' circles usually drew on the intelligentsia for education. This upsurge of the working class had tremendous power because the working workers were concentrated in large-scale and sometimes gigantic factories. The state made concessions to the workers, including, in the mid-90s, passing laws to limit hours of work. The significance of this fact, too, was not lost on the revolutionary intelligentsia. But the political system remained savagely authoritarian and brutally repressive. The pattern was, as it would continue to be for most of the time until the February 1917 revolution, that the leaders and organizers of Marxist circles would have a short period of activity and then inevitably be arrested, jailed, and deported to forced exile in Siberia. That was the fate of the leaders of the St. Petersburg League of Struggle. Markov, Lenin, and others were arrested in December 1897 and after imprisonment exiled until 1900. Ulyanov then went abroad. Continuity and tradition in the Marxist circles was often rendered impossible. The characteristics of whomever replaced those arrested would come to dominate each circle. That ultimately weakened Marxism as a consistent force and would have as one of its consequences the revival of a sort of populism. But there was another strange and contradictory dimension to the rise of Marxism, to hegemony over the intelligentsia and in the revolutionary circles. In parallel to the growth of non-revolutionary populism, there grew up from 1894 a legal Marxism. A number of writers and intellectuals used aspects of Marxism to try and finally to bury populism. Struve, Tugan, Baranovsky, and Bulgakov boldly seized those aspects of Marxism which preached that the development of Russian capitalism was not only inevitable and necessary, but progressive, and the only road through which socialism could eventually be reached. They came to argue that capitalism should therefore be championed by those who wanted to promote the welfare of Russia, the Russian people, and the Russian industrial proletariat. They published books and collections of articles. Ulyanov contributed an essay to one of them, in which they turned Marxism into a champion of Russian capitalism. The older populists had rejected and resisted that objective side of Marxism, even when the revolutionary side of Marxism was also their full strength. They called the Marxists, or that aspect of Plekhanov's Marxism, apologetics for capitalism and for capitalist exploitation. That had been unjust. With the legal Marxist, it became essentially true. The Tsarist authorities looked with limited favour on the work of the legal Marxists with their heavy tomes, seeing them as valuable allies against the populists, who had spawned and would again spawn terrorists against Tsarism, and allowed them to publish some works legally. Thus the name legal Marxism, though it came to have other connotations too, those of adulterated, truncated and part-payment Marxism. Soon they would subscribe to the critical thinking revision of Marxism in the West and undertaken by some Marxist writers, and in the first place by Eduard Bernstein, breaking with revolutionary Marxism. All of these Russian Bernsteinists would become liberals or reactionaries. Bulkanov became a Russian Orthodox priest. Although initially the legal Marxist did valuable work in spreading a form of Marxism, it would take a political battle between revolutionary Marxists based on the working class, where the labour movements based themselves on elements of the intelligentsia, travelling rightwards from populism to liberalism, and the Struves to put Marxism back into the revolutionary keel. Decades later, Trotsky would sum up what legal Marxists did as that they had helped sever the umbilical cord that bound the intelligentsia to populism. He also observed that it was not the revolutionary populists, starting with a bomb and bullet for Tsars and Tsarist officials who destroyed Russian Tsarism, but those who started out with heavy tomes under their arms and worked to educate and organize the proletariat. The revolutionary role would be made possible only as a result of a whole series of differentiations among the intelligentsia, in which those who stood with the working class and for working class revolution separated themselves by way of polemic and dispute from all the others. In the late 1890s, the nebulous state of Russian socialism, consisting as it did of a myriad of separate circles, each independent of the others, producing its own factory leaflets and occasionally more ambitious publications, allowed a certain revival of populism that would lead to the creation in 1901-2 by Viktor Chernov and others of the Socialist Revolutionary Party, which would insist that socialism was an immediate possibility in Russia, refuse to draw any basic distinction between peasants and wage workers, all were the people or the working class, and use terrorism against Tsarist officials. Against the background, the pioneers and veterans of the Group for the Emancipation of Labour and a group of those who had become Marxists in the 1890s, Lenin, Martov, Potresov, Dan and others set out to bring political and ideological order and organisation to the large but amorphous Russian Marxist movement and to build a revolutionary working class party. At the end of 1900, they published the first number of a newspaper, Iskra, and a journal, Zarya, that began a campaign to win the Russian Marxists to common ideas and a single revolutionary party organized initially around. In 1898, a small and unrepresentative gathering in Minsk had declared the existence of a Russian Social Democratic Labour Party. Peter Struve wrote its manifesto. Most of the delegates were soon arrested. The RSDLP existed only as a name and an aspiration until its second, effectively its first, Congress in mid-1903, prepared for by 2.5 years' work by Iskra and Zarya. Notes. Struve survived to 1944, by which time he favoured the Nazis as more progressive than the system in Stalinist Russia. Page 13. Against Cuts, Fight for Free Education by Owen Flood. Nearly 50 universities are now either making job cuts or have already made cuts. A UCU survey shows at least 12 institutions plan 50 or more job cuts. These cuts will result in huge numbers of course closures and fewer contact hours for students. Many cuts are being achieved through voluntary redundancies. For example, Swansea University will see 180 job cuts through a scheme started at the start of the academic year. Arts and humanities subjects are the most at risk. Cuts are also being made to STEM, health education and teacher training. For example, 60 academic positions in Aston University's College of Engineering and Physical Sciences are at risk of redundancy due to a proposal to shut down some chemistry programs and restructure many departments. Very many post-92 universities for former polytechnics are affected. At Sheffield's Hallam University, a strike ballot opened on Monday, 15th of April to the 22nd of May. The university is threatening to cut 225 academic jobs, with up to 80 staff facing compulsory redundancy. 150 have already left through a voluntary severance scheme, yet the cuts continue. A restructuring of professional services will badly affect student welfare. Cuts are being seen at prestigious universities. However, the vast majority are at less high-flying institutions that struggle to compete by recruiting students. Many of those are in smaller cities where universities are one of the better and more secure employers, and course closures and job cuts will leave many in the local communities worse off. Universities are claiming cuts are necessary because of falls in student recruitment. At a university, a UK survey of 70 different institutions found that there was a 44% decrease in international postgraduates enrolling. However, it is unclear whether universities are making cuts out of actual financial necessity or because they feel under pressure to ensure they remain competitive in the higher education markets. Many universities making cuts are sitting on a lot of money, yet are unwilling to keep jobs and courses. At many universities, local branches of the higher education unions are fighting the cuts. At Aberdeen University, they've managed to beat back cuts in modern languages. Formal disputes, ballots and industrial action have started at Goldsmiths, Sheffield Hallam, Lincoln, Kent, Winchester and the Open University. These individual battles are important, but the University and College Union, UCU, and other unions have not taken up the baton to tackle the cuts on a national level. The most recent communication from UCU to members on 19th of April did not mention the wave of cuts. Even mention of particular disputes were buried halfway down the email. The lack of national response lets down the workforce and could lead to demoralisation. This is a critical moment and requires an urgent response. Trade union activists in universities need to put pressure on their unions at both branch and national level to step up the fight. Unions need to make the argument that increasing the fees of home or international students will not solve the issue, but simply kick it into the long grass. Unions need to argue that a sector so dependent on fees and recruitment is inherently precarious. It is an irresponsible way to run a public service. Increasing fees is unfair to students who will be saddled with more debt or priced out of university education. To win longer-term job security in the higher education system that serves the interests of society as a whole, an overhaul in the funding system is needed. Free education for home and international students, maintenance grants for all, funded by taxing the rich. Activists in union branches facing cuts should link up with each and call on the national leaderships to create a strategy for tackling them, one which includes working closely with other unions and with students. The basic demand should be opposition to cuts and the universities open the books on their finances. Union branches not affected by cuts can and must play an important role by supporting those facing cuts, such as mobilising financial support for strike funds. The institutions care about their public image, and students and the community can put pressure by protesting at open days and visits days. Amazon workers win ballots, go ahead, by Ollie Moore. The Central Arbitration Committee, CAC, the government's body which oversees the regulation of trade unions and claims for trade union recognition, has accepted a submission from the GMB union for recognition at Amazon's BHX4 warehouse in Coventry. The CAC's decision means a ballot of workers at the site can now take place. If a majority of workers vote to be collectively represented by the union, Amazon will be legally obligated to recognise and bargain with the GMB. Such a step would be historic, representing the first formal union agreement at any Amazon site in the UK. GMB must now negotiate with Amazon via the CAC over the terms of the ballot. Unlike ballots for industrial action, there is no requirement for union recognition ballots to be conducted by post. They can take place in the workplace. Given Amazon's aggressively anti-union attitude, it is likely to make every effort to frustrate the process and obstruct the GMB campaigning. Amazon managers have recently been holding meetings with workers in groups and one on one at BHX4, encouraging them to leave the union. The company also produced a leaflet with a QR code that directs workers to the page on the GMB website to cancel their union membership. A statement from Rosa Curling, director of Fox Club, the legal firm assisting the union with its claim, said, quote, "Amazon is going to pull every dirty trick in the book to keep unions out of their UK warehouses, but the Coventry workers have history on their side," end quotes. GMB wants union recognition in order to pursue its demands for a £15 hour minimum wage, as well as other improvements to workplace conditions. BHX4 workers will strike again as part of that campaign on the 1st of May, International Workers' Day. Workplace leaders at the EMA4 site in Sutton Coldfields, Birmingham, also plan further strikes. Planning meetings to back the campaign at BHX4, 7:30 p.m. Thursday, 2nd of May, at the Friends Meeting House, Hill Street, Coventry, CV1, 4 a.m. Action at Goldsmiths by Cathy Nugent. On Friday, the 19th of April, academic staff at Goldsmiths Uni in South London began a marking and assessment boycott, MAB, as part of a programme of industrial action to stop the axing of a proposed 132.132.3 rolls. Many more staff members than this figure have been put in scope for redundancy. The union is currently tackling the first stage of the compulsory redundancy process, in which 11 out of 19 departments are affected. As elsewhere, a financial shortfall and declining student numbers have been blamed for the cuts, even though voluntary redundancies, deleting of vacant posts, and almost certainly staff leaving for more secure institutions will cover the deficit. It is now vital that students support the MAB. If these cuts go through, education at Goldsmiths will be hugely impoverished. As the open letter from PhD students puts it, quote, "We refuse to be at an institution where the redundancy of over a quarter of the staff will further impact severely damaged departments and our student experience. We see you marginalising arts and humanities in favour of a political STEM agenda. We do not want the college to be rendered into a faceless corporate machine, a trap of academic exploitation only labelled as progressive studies," end quotes. Goldsmiths UCU are looking to spread solidarity for the dispute. They want UCU to call on all its members across the UK to boycott official Goldsmiths activity. The union plans events on campus to draw in support from the local community and trade unions. These plans, alongside actions taken by other UCU branches, could kickstart nationally coordinated action over the cuts. Page 14. Help us raise £15,000 by the 21st of July. A good week in the run-up to the conference saw us take in an extra £1,450. Thanks to Lawrence, Andrew, John and Brian. Total so far, £5,142. Bob Crowe, Differences and Limits. Diary of a Track Worker by Matt Shaw. In my last column, I wrote about the first two of the five general secretaries our union, NUR, then RMT, has had since I started on the railway. Following Jimmy Knapp's unexpected death in 2001, a snap election was called. The office bureaucrat's choice was Ray Spryshute, a legacy candidate from Sid Wehill's time. The left-backed assistant general secretary, Bob Crowe, who had the advantage of being fairly well known, with a repute for aggressive behaviour to management. Some still had reservations about Scrowe, myself included, as his personal political history was as a member of the Communist Party, with a sometimes Stalinoid attitude to organisation and the membership. Many of the people backing him as the left alternative to the bureaucracy went on to become part of a new bureaucracy, just as obstructive as the old lot. Crowe had attended a lot of Grades conferences as an assistant general secretary. Before that, he had attended as a lay delegate. He would be selling the Morning Star, the Communist Party's newspaper, with a shout about it being the only paper that was owned by workers. After another left-wing paper seller pointed out that their paper was also owned by workers, he changed his cry to the only daily newspaper owned by workers. When Assistant General Secretary of our union, he also became our rep on the National Executive of the Labour Party. Being a member of the Communist Party was now a problem, easily solved by him through resigning from the CP and renouncing his membership of over 14 years. In the years after privatisation, the union had lost over 50,000 members from about 100,000. One of the RMT's achievements in Crowe's time was to push that back up to over 80,000. That was due to a greater willingness to take industrial action. But, and it's a big but, those figures don't reflect what could have been achieved with a better plan of attack and not just protests, strikes. The signalers' strikes in 2006 are a good example, not striking to win outright, just to cause disruption in the short term. There would be further examples under the next two general secretaries. Bob also saw the union leave the Labour Party in 2004. The move played to a certain faction inside the RMT who wanted to follow Arthur Scargill's Socialist Labour Party and talked of establishing a new workers' party. It did not come off. Neither the Scargill SLP nor RMT-backed efforts like NO2EU 2009 established themselves as living alternatives to the Labour Party. Bob Crowe tended to be somewhat all things to all people. He never quite delivered on what the membership wanted or deserved. His untimely death in 2014 left a void that unfortunately was filled by a placeholder, an older sort of leader, Mick Cash. Adaptations of 1984, Kino Eye by John Cunningham. It's 40 years since 1984, and the book was written in 1949. There are two main film adaptations, both of them worth seeing. 1984, directed by Michael Anderson in 1956, includes in its cast the excellent Donald Pleasence as Mr. Parsons, a co-worker of Winston Smith's. It is a black-and-white, no-frills adaptation, which for sheer bleakness has few equals in cinema. The better-known 1984, a close adaptation of the book directed by Michael Radford, was actually shot in 1984 and stars John Hurt as Winston Smith with Richard Burton as O'Brien, making his last screen appearance before he died. Radford was displeased that Virgin, the producers, including the soundtrack, in the soundtrack some music by the Eurythmics without his permission, and withdrew the film from the BAFTA ceremonies in protest. Terry Gilliam's Brazil 1985, only loosely based on 1984, features Jonathan Pryce as Sam Laurie, replacing the Winston Smith character, and Robert De Niro as a cavalier resistance fighter. It is a bizarre, semi-surrealist romp. It has some of the key Big Brother elements of the Radford's film, but its enthusiastic embrace of the grotesque puts everything in a different place. Ukraine appeal. After raising over £15,000 for a hospital in Novoselensk The Ukraine Solidarity Campaign has launched a new appeal for mining, rescue and firefighting operations in the eastern region of Donetsk, near the front line. The appeal is sponsored by the UK National Union of Mine Workers, which has links with the Workers' Union, NGPU, and by the London Fire Brigade branch of Unison. The USC crowdfunder also includes a list of what the workers have requested. Page 15. Votes for strikes and new PCS leaders by a PCS member. National Executive NEC elections are now underway in the Civil Service Unions Union PCS, pitting the Coalition for Change, spearheaded by the PCS Independent Left, including AWL supporters, and the Broad Left Network against the long misruling Left Unity. Although LU has a very large majority on the NEC, the Change Coalition is in a good position to win seats and to win the elections. The coalition is based on a principles programme for change focused on the critical problems facing PCS members. LU uninspiringly offers its, quotes, its proud history in delivering for members, end quotes, when civil service real pay has been declining during 16 years of pay freezes and below inflation awards, when tens of thousands of members are on the minimum wage, and when low membership levels undermine our industrial leverage. Coalition for Change supporters entered the NEC elections, buoyed by the elections last year, when the LIL's John Maloney was convincingly re-elected as Assistant General Secretary. BLN's Marion Lloyd was only narrowly defeated for General Secretary, and together they secured a high total vote than their LU opponents. Coalition supporters proceeded to deliver a significant number of branch nominations for coalition candidates, neck and neck with the members for the previously dominant LU. The enthusiasm for the Change Coalition was reflected in the very well-attended and very positive IL-BLN election launch meeting on 17th of April. Nevertheless, all of us supporting the Change Coalition must now work hard to win the NEC elections, rather than relying on membership disenchantment with LU. The early signs are positive as supporters take the arguments to members in and outside the workplaces, seeking to persuade them to vote yes in the current industrial election ballots over pay, closing 13th of May, and to elect a new NEC for the battles ahead. Ballot closes 9th of May. Two vital ballots. Unison NEC backs Ukraine solidarity by Elaine Jones. A motion calling for solidarity with Ukraine has been submitted to this year's National Delegate Conference in DC of the Public Services Union Unison, 18th to the 21st of June, 21st of June, Brighton. Motion number 95, submitted by South Lanarkshire Local Government Branch and supported by the Scottish Region, calls for Unison to actively support Ukraine's struggle for liberation from Russian imperialism, to strengthen links with the Ukrainian unions, and to affiliate to the Ukrainian Solidarity Campaign. In unison, all motions submitted to conference are discussed at the National Executive NEC Committee that the subjects relates to, and a recommendation is given to support, oppose, support with qualification, or with an amendment to, or defer. Then they go to the full NEC. The motion on Ukraine first went to the International Committee, which voted to oppose, and then came to the NEC. In Time for Real Change, TFRC, the main movement of left activists in unison, there are differences of opinion on Ukraine. The SWP and Stop the War are active in TFRC. Their supporters and Socialist Alternative opposed the motion. However, it was clearly stated that TFRC does not have a position on this and other international issues, so TFRC people could express their own views. Workers' Liberty comrades and others spoke at the NEC to support the motion. The debate at the NEC was heated. Many people spoke and some clearly changed their position in debate. The final vote was 22 in favour, 21 against, 14 abstentions. Some of the abstentions were international committee members who were reminded that by union rule they couldn't support, only abstain. This was an important vote and its outcome was welcomed by Ukrainian trade unionists. We must now get the debates prioritised at NDC. There is an online statement supported by John McDonnell MP calling for support for the motion and an online meeting 27th of May, 7 p.m. Unison must stand with Ukraine and the workers' movement, with speakers including Ukrainian trade unionists and John McDonnell MP. Elaine Jones is a member of Unison's NEC, writing here in a personal capacity. Court win on right to strike by Janine Booth. The UK Supreme Court rules on the Wednesday, 17th of April, that's a UK law allowing employers to discipline but not sack workers for striking is in conflict with the European Convention on Human Rights, ECHR. The usual course following a judgment such as this is that the UK government will table a statutory instrument to Parliament to specify in UK law that it is unlawful for employers to discipline workers in any way for taking part in official industrial action. However, it is possible that a Tory government, worrying that its days are numbered, may decide not to do this, or may decide instead to repeal the ECHR provisions or even the whole Human Rights Act. Until UK law is amended to comply with the 17th April judgment, employers are still allowed under the UK law to discipline strikers. Any striker disciplined can take a case to the European Court of Human Rights, but that can take a while. The 17th of April judgment concluded a case has taken 4 years. Trade union Unison took the case to Employment Tribunal in 2020 on behalf of its member, care worker Fiona Mercher. The union won the initial court case, but while the employer was willing to accept the result and not appeal, the Tory government appealed and succeeded in overturning the tribunal decision. Today's judgment overturns the appeal result and restores the original decision. Fiona has been involved in a dispute, her employer Northwest's charity AFG, over its plans to cut sleep over payments. Page 16. Trump's trial and a UAW victory by Tom Harrison. On the day a jury was finalized for the Trump campaign finance fraud case, aka the hush money trial, Max Accelerio fatally set himself on fire outside of the courthouse after throwing leaflets around advancing conspiracy theories. Hopefully his pointless death will be one of the only a few of the current presidential election season plays out. Some social media comments pointed out that Azzarello was a Florida resident and his home state is bottom of the pile for per capita spending on mental health programs. Others were inclined to cite the poor spending on public education in the states, with Florida given an F for efforts in one recent national survey. The woeful state of the US public education system was dramatically demonstrated on season 4 of acclaimed TV series The Wire, and things haven't improved since then. This is a country where some states are quite happy for teachers to carry guns into classrooms, and Georgia's Lieutenant Governor wants to pay them $10K extra a year to do so. Well, many teachers have to fund markets and other school supplies out of their own pockets. One of the high-profile election deniers, Kerry Lake, has told her supporters in Arizona to strap on a Glock because, quote, it's going to be a crazy run the next 6 months, end quotes. Lake hopes her helping up the violent rhetoric will be enough for her to be chosen as Trump's VP. That Trump is one big criminal reprobate and con artist has been obvious for years. Journalist John Sweeney's 2013 interview with him concerning mob links is pretty conclusive proof of that. Trump fits in with a sorry American tradition of hucksters hoodwinking the gullible in the general population. The Brexit experience shows that can happen elsewhere, but people seem particularly prone to it in America. Sinclair Lewis, the first American writer to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, wrote about this in a couple of his novels, the most famous being Elmer Gentry. He based the title character, a money-obsessed sexual predator, on various grifting evangelical preachers around at the time, whom Lewis and the socialist writer John Reed denounced as beholden to big business interests. The sight of Trump selling Bibles for $59 throw when religious organizations give them away fits in with the tradition of religious huckstering. The wealthy elite, like the massive tax cuts Trump made whilst in the White House, but hesitate about lending him any money. This has been particularly evident on the $175 million bonds Trump had to raise when challenging the judgment in his civil fraud trial. The bond has apparently been guaranteed by a notorious loan shark, Don Henke, who operates in the subprime market, lending at eye-watering interest rates of up to 260%. It's speculated that Henke put up the money in the hope that Trump in the Oval Office would keep the IRS and DOJ off Henke's back. The finance between the bonds are now subject to legal challenge. Then we have the whole saga of Truth Social stock being floated on Wall Street, only to plummet so much in one day that the shares were being referred to as shitcoin. This is said to be an example of a pump-and-dump scheme, and it's not going to benefit most investors stupid enough to put money into it. None of these sharp practices get an airing in the Trump echo chamber that is Fox News and Newsmax. They spent jury selection week trashing the jury. Fox virtually revealed the identity of a potential jurors. Additional comments that liberal activists were lying to the judge in order to get on the jury were riposted by Trump in violation of the supposed gag order he's under. The chosen jurors may very well feel intimidated already into not convicting Trump. It only takes one or two to waver in a case where the evidence would be pretty conclusive if anyone else were up for trial. Trump's media allies are going all out to delegitimize the process should a guilty verdict be returned. Among Trump voters, 13% say they wouldn't vote for him again if he secured a criminal conviction. But how many of them will change their minds and vote back into office a person who believes that Hitler did some good things? If it's not all doom and gloom, though, the United Auto Workers, UAW, has won a historic victory by unionizing workers at the Volkswagen factory at Chattanooga, Tennessee, after defeats in 2014 and 2019 recognition ballots. This could open the way for unionization in other factories in the American South? Can this be built on and translated to a political level that represents the true interests of the American working class? Reverse the Brexit Fiasco by Rodri Evans. From 30th of April, border checks will start on imports coming to Britain and the European Union. Nearly 8 years after the Brexit votes, over 4 years after the UK formally quit the EU, and after many postponements, the UK will finally start checking items one by one rather than having a free flow of the EU single market. Except, not yet. The government will run selective checks and for a while yet will set the rate of checks to zero, i.e. not check. Quotes, it is beyond frustrating that businesses will have to try to navigate this clearly broken system, end quotes, said a lobbyist for the perishable goods trade. Check on exports to the EU from Britain, long active, have reduced those exports, and the new checks will bring price rises and supply delays for stuff imported from the EU. Brexit makes sense only for the section of the capitalist class which thinks it can use it to reduce worker, environmental and consumer productions in the UK way below EU standards, something even Sunak's Tories have so far shied off from. A big majority in Britain now say Brexit was wrong, but since the EU has proposed a youth mobility scheme for people aged 18 to 13 to move freely between the EU and the UK to work or to study, but Starmer has followed the Tories in saying no on the grounds that youth mobility would amount to free movement of people. Well, yes, and a good thing too. Solidarity agitates for Labour to reverse Brexit. Nottingham plans anti-cuts May Day by Liam Conway. Nottingham's Save Our Services SOS campaign, which is organising against the cuts being made by government commissioners imposed on the council, had 100 people at a meeting in the Meadows area of the city on 16th of April. The meeting was supported by local people involved with the Meadows Library, the Bowls Club and the Queen's Walk Community Centre, where the public meeting took place. All three are threatened with closure. Consultation on the libraries is due to open in early May. On Saturday, 20th of April, an open event was held in the Sherwoods ward of the city at the Place Community Centre, which is also facing the possibility of closure. 300 people came to the event and many signed up to the SOS campaign. The next big focus for the SOS campaign will be the May Day rally on 4th of May, called by the Trades Council. Redundancy processes have begun in some parts of the council, for example in adult care services. Management say there will be 554 job losses across the council over a four-year period. So far nationally, the council unions, the GMB, Unite and Unison, have effectively been silent. Meanwhile, the leader of the council, David Mellon, is stepping down and Labour Party head office has stepped in to impose a new leader. So democracy will play no part in deciding who should lead the Labour group or the council in the city. Page 17. Israel-Iran Against War by Ira Bekovic. Overnight on 18th of April, a missile struck a site in Isfahan, Iran. Although Israel has not formally claimed responsibility, US military officials have reported to the press that the missile was an Israeli attack, a response to the 13th of April Iranian missiles aimed at Israel, which in turn responded to the 1st April Israeli bombing of an Iranian diplomatic building in Syria. Despite a near unanimous diplomatic consensus in favour of de-escalation, the risk of a major war between Iran and Israel remains real. At the time of writing, the Iranian regime was downplaying the attack and saying they have no plans to retaliate immediately. In Israel, far-right government minister Itamar Ben-Gvir commented on social media that the attack was lame. Many on Israel's far-right have long called for Israel to launch an all-out war on Iran. Solidarity does not see attacks on Israel by Iran or its allies as a potential component of the struggle for Palestinian liberation. It is understandable for Israeli Jews to feel threatened by the bellicosity of a clerical fascist regime governed by virulent anti-Semites, but the bellicosity of their own government, which contains political currents which are the Jewish near equivalents of Hamas, makes them less safe, not more. One of the slogans of Standing Together, left-wing Arab Jewish socialist movement in Israel, affirms that, quotes, only peace will bring security, end quotes. The long-term security of all people in the region can only be guaranteed via social transformation that removes the ultra-nationalist fascists and religious supremacists on all sides from power. The left-wing Iranian academic Arish Azizi posted on social media, quoting an Iranian trade union statement, quotes, the eventual victims of these attacks will be women, children, and the oppressed whose livelihoods have been attacked. In all-out war, interests of neither of the two nations who are saddled with religious and fascist governments will be secured, end quotes.